Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The James Jordan murder was the story in the Chicago Tribune on Sunday. I read the story online on Friday. I talked briefly about it on my show Saturday and hoped that we would have been able to connect with the author of it, Dan Wiederer, yesterday. We could not. You may have seen the story, though. It's really remarkable. 25 years, he wrote, since Michael Jordan's father was murdered beside a road in North Carolina. It's a crime that in part prompted the Bulls star's retirement from basketball and sent two teenagers to prison for life. And then he talks at some length about the story, particularly about a young man named Daniel Green, who did not, it appears, pull the trigger, and Larry Demery, who may have. But it's two young men who were convicted of the crime and sent to jail. Remember, it was one gunshot to the chest that killed James Jordan. So one of them pulled the trigger, one of them did not. So many odd circumstances surround Jordan's death, he wrote. Jordan's body was not discovered in his car, but turned up in a swamp in South Carolina 11 days after the murder. His 1992 Lexus was not discovered on the side of the road where he had purportedly slept, but abandoned in the woods near Fayetteville, North Carolina, 60 miles from where his body was found. A total of 21 days passed before family members reported Jordan missing. His 57th birthday came and went on July 31st, 9 days after he had last been seen alive. His father had been murdered, shot once in the chest less than 5 weeks earlier. Michael and James were there atop the NBA world after Jordan and the Bulls won another championship. And then on he goes to recount that story. And we found him over at Bears training camp. Hey, Dan, welcome back. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
What a story. How much work did it take to dig all of these facts and people back up?
Yeah, certainly more involved and more complex than probably anything that I've worked on in my journalism career. I think the level of sophistication of sort of trying to unravel the layers of this crime and going through court documents and old trial testimony and new motions and then talking to the prosecutor and the defense attorneys and those who were involved and trying to get a hold of people. It was a laborious process and consumed a lot of my life for the last 6 months. A lot to get at. And really, we only scratched the surface, believe it or not, with the story that we wrote both at ChicagoTribune.com and in the paper. There is so much more to this, and it's really fascinating to know that something like this could have as many layers as it does.
Well, you can tell that there's a lot to it, right? I mean, it's coincident with Michael Jordan not only losing his father and winning a third NBA ring, but then leaving basketball for baseball. And a lot of people tie those things together. There's conspiracy theories all about that. You don't really go down that road as much as you do that road in North Carolina, and you tell us what happened. And I was stunned at some of the details that you revealed, particularly as they regard the sheriff and some of the locals involved.
Well, a couple of things struck me when we started working on this story, and one of the first ones being that the way the murder was so often commonly remembered by people was that James Jordan was shot in his car, and most people just sort of remembered, okay, he was found in his car, they found these teens, they put him in jail, and that was that. And then you realize some of the things that you just read, that Jordan's body didn't surface for 11 days after the murder, that his car was 60 miles away from where the body surfaced, that there was really not a lot of physical evidence to support the idea that he was napping in his car alongside a road in North Carolina. And so when you start there, when you have difficulty getting to step one of what the sort of accepted narrative from authorities was, that James Jordan was asleep in his car, taking a nap on a drive from Wilmington to Charlotte as he tried to get back home and was shot inside his car, and then you learn that there was no blood definitively found inside the car, and there was no exit wound in his body, and you start to sort of ask questions on, is this what really happened? And one of the most difficult parts of this is people want answers, right? And I think you get to the end of the story and you don't have them. And so how do you deal with that uncertainty, right?
Well, two people were convicted for this 25 years ago yesterday. Let's just talk about what we know or suspect we know happened. He's driving his car, and he pulls over on the side of the road. Am I right so far?
Yeah, so the last he was seen, he was attending a funeral of a former coworker in Wilmington, got in his car after midnight, was headed to Charlotte, and was supposed to fly to Chicago the following day. And what we know at that point is that he never made it, and that we know where his body surfaced, and that when Daniel Green and Larry Demery, the two teens that were ultimately convicted of this murder, sort of gave their stories, it led authorities to believe that at the intersection of Interstate 95 and U.S. 74 highway, that's where James Jordan's car was, and that is where they say that the murder occurred.
They say, the young men that were convicted of his murder, right?
They and the authorities, you know, the prosecution and the those who investigated.
So we believe that James Jordan was driving along, had a flight the next morning, must have been getting tired, pulls over the side of the road to, late at night, take a nap, right?
Correct.
And you say that's kind of curious because he had sufficient means to pay for a night in a motel, maybe even for just a few hours. I know people that nap on the side of the road because they don't want to pay a full day's fare at a motel, even a cheap one, when they know they're only going to sleep for an hour or two. So maybe that's logical, but you say it's curious that he was just a couple hundred yards from a $30 a night motel, right?
Sure, and even more curious, I think, to me, is this, accepted narrative from the authorities that he was in the front seat of his car, startled awake from a nap, and he was shot. To be shot from the passenger side window in the driver's seat and have no exit wound in the body and no blood in the car is something that Daniel Green's attorneys have highlighted and say, look, we need to ask more detailed questions about whether that's plausible, whether that's believable, and whether that is an acceptable explanation of how this murder occurred. And so that is one of the key points that they have brought up as they you know, another thing that attracted me to the story is not only was this a fascinating crime 25 years ago, but there's still modern day news peg to this with Daniel Green fighting for his, you know, freedom in the North Carolina judicial system. And here we are 25 years later, and there's still ongoing legal proceedings occurring with this case.
Well, so it's not believed that James Jordan pulled up on a drug scene gone bad, but rather that he was there napping. These two young kids come upon him. They're going to rob him and then decide, heck, we're going to steal the car too. They shoot him, one of them, maybe the other guy, Demery, shoots him from the passenger window side into the chest. And then what happens? Then they drive him in the car, is that it, to another location? What happens then?
Daniel Green's version of the story is that he was never there, that he was not at the site of the murder when it happened, that he was at a cookout the night before, and it was the early hours in the morning when Larry Demery had come back to the trailer park where he was spending the night and was shaken, in Daniel Green's words, that he came back asking for help, and at that point he drove back, saw James Jordan's body for the first time, and decided that his number one priority was to be loyal to a close friend and to help him cover this up. And so eventually, you know, the body is in the car and they drive it across the state line into South Carolina and drop it into Gum Swamp. And it sits there for 11 days before a local fisherman stumbles upon it and realizes that something has gone haywire and ultimately gets the police involved in the case.
It being James Jordan's body, and then they take the car and some of the stuff inside. In fact, was it Green who was then seen online in a video prancing around in Michael Jordan's jersey that he had given his father?
They were wearing a watch that Michael Jordan had given his father, as well as a ring that had come from the 1986 All-Star game. And so, the prosecutor said, look, this is a snapshot of who Daniel Green is, that he had some of the spoils of the crime and was willing to flaunt them in a sort of a homemade rap video that surfaced and was part of which was presented at his trial in 1996. There are just so many layers to this case and the backdrop of it being in this area of North Carolina where there has long been sort of suspicion of corruption within law enforcement adds just this whole other element of head scratch to it and makes you sort of question who can you believe when everyone sort of involved in this case seems to have some questions about them.
Well, particularly, okay, so then they get in the car and they use James Jordan's cell phone in the car to make a bunch of phone calls. It's in part how they were caught, but you also say that I believe it's the second phone call they made is really curious, isn't it? And that's one of the things that I knew nothing about. the second phone call. Tell us about that after this. We're talking to Dan Wiederer. You read his stories about the Chicago Bears these days, but yesterday, on the 25th anniversary of the murder of Michael Jordan's father, there was a story online. It actually went up over the weekend, and it was in print on Sunday, about James Jordan's death, and we're talking a little bit about that story. And the two young men, which is really the focus of the story, Daniel Green and Larry Demery, were convicted of the murder. Daniel Green said, "I wasn't there, I didn't do it." And the way the story's been unfolding, Larry came upon a sleeping James Jordan, shot him, killed him, went and got his friend Daniel Green and said, "I did a terrible thing." They get back in the car, they dump James Jordan's body, and then later make some phone calls on the phone in the car, right, Dan?
Yeah, and that's ultimately what led authorities to bringing them into custody and ultimately arresting them, is that they had made 36 phone calls in a four-day period from James Jordan's Lexus phone, and the phone calls were made to friends and relatives, and easily sort of led authorities back to Daniel Green and Larry Demery, and, you know, basically told them that they were involved with this crime in some capacity.
Well, you want evidence that bad guys are dumb. There it is. I mean, really? You're calling your family and friends. You don't think that they don't know how to trace James Jordan's cell phone calls? You're still using that phone to call your friends? Oh, who did they call? Let's call those people. What do all these things have in common? Larry and Danny. Holy cow. You guys, you could not leave more breadcrumbs for the authorities, right?
It's ultimately what got them caught. And yeah, as you mentioned earlier, the first call from the Lexus went to a 1-800 sex hotline. And then the second call went to a number that Daniel Green's attorneys say needed to be explored a little bit further. It was the number registered to the biological son of the Robeson County Sheriff. And it was a call that Daniel Green's attorneys contend was never investigated thoroughly, and that Larry Deese, the biological son of the sheriff, was never formally questioned, or at least there's not documentation of that anywhere to show that he was thoroughly investigated. And so they say, look, take a look at that call and tell us whether something smells fishy in this case. And it's something that they would like to bring up if they are allowed an evidentiary hearing in the motion that Daniel Green has pending in the North Carolina judicial.
Well, how do these two punks know the phone number of the sheriff in town's son, and why did they call him after the murder?
The biological son of the sheriff was a well-known drug trafficker in Robeson County at the time, a cocaine trafficker who was known by authorities. By the time Daniel Green went to trial in 1996, Larry Deese was in jail after being caught up in a DEA investigation that connected him to a cocaine trafficking ring. And so that's, again, another one of these head-scratching elements in this case where you say, wow, there are a lot of characters involved in this case, and there are a lot of questions that don't have easy answers.
Okay,
and Daniel Green's attorney... Go ahead.
Well, is the implication maybe that it was a contract killing, or that somehow the sheriff's son was connected to James Jordan's death?
That's a question that Daniel Green's attorneys want at least asked, on whether that call was significant in any way, shape, or form. Now, the prosecutor, Johnson Britt, would say there is no proof that call was ever answered. There is no proof on who made that call. There is no proof that even in subsequent days that Daniel Green and Larry Demery tried to meet back up with Larry Deese to connect with him. But there is an implication that look, there may have been some form of drug dealing connection in this case. And if so, is Larry Deese involved in that? And that's one of the issues that Daniel Green's lawyers want to sort of put out there and have a chance to explore further in the judicial system.
You do not spend much time in the story, any really, talking about, was James Jordan's death connected in any way to Michael Jordan's gambling debts? In your reporting on that, did you find anything to connect those? It's been a question for fans ever since his passing.
There has never been anything to connect the two things. Obviously, as you know, in 1993, that speculation was immediate and it mushroomed quickly. And really, in the days after James Jordan's murder was confirmed, Michael Jordan released a statement sort of condemning those who rushed to judgment and made irresponsible speculative connections to his own gambling issues and his father's death, and said that it really hurt him and really complicated his grieving process.
Yeah.
To have those rumors and innuendos out there. There has never been tangible proof that there or any shred of evidence that connects those. But as you know, here we are 25 years later, it comes up with people when you bring that up. And so it's one of those complicated sort of issues. The reason we didn't have it in the story is because there is no connection, and there has been no evidence. And so it's really one of those sub layers that will always exist, but has to be sort of viewed through the proper lens.
Well, that's why I called you, and that's why I'm really glad you said that. And then all of those other layers and lenses are in the story. If you have not yet, click it. It's the James Jordan murder at ChicagoTribune.com. And it's a fascinating story. It's well reported and in depth. We'll talk about other sports stories maybe this fall, but it's nice to talk to you today. Well done, Dan. It's intriguing reading, I'll say that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and thanks for discussing it.